Right. I would imagine you could really think of it.
It's like 15.
Okay.
I'm trying not to. It's harder to see.
So good morning, everyone. Can you hear me? Is this mic working? My name is Meredith Tooley, and I'm a member of the board of directors for the Maine Fishermen's Forum. So I'm the host for this session this morning on the state of the ecosystem, and so I just wanted to welcome you all. We have some esteemed scientists from the Northeast Science Center with us here this morning, and John Hare, who is new director to the Science Center as of this year, although he is well known to many of us and been around for a good amount of time. So we have also John Anderson with us here this morning, who's going to be speaking as well, and on this topic, which is very relevant both in many management bodies, particularly at the New England Fishery Management Council these days, and so it's the newest and latest, and I will turn it over to John.
Thank you very much, Mary Beth. So Sarah Geiches, who is going to give this presentation through a walkthrough, this State of the Ecosystem Report, sends her apologies for not being able to come. And since I was here, I told her that I could walk through the State of the Ecosystem Report. But then we also thought, since John Manderson was here, we'd take the opportunity at about 11:30 to sort of stop the conversation about the State of the Ecosystem Report and show some of the work that the center is doing to incorporate ecosystem information with industry information to sort of push the envelope on how we're working with industry to understand both the ecosystem and fisheries. So the purpose of this sort of first section is to go through sort of briefly the State of the Ecosystem Report, which has been developed from the center. We put it together about every 2 years. The first iteration was in 2009 and 2012, so we're coming up on completing the third iteration. And what we want to do is sort of just talk about what we've done in the past, get your input on sort of the information that we're including, and also what information could we include to improve the utility of the report to you. We produce this to inform the public, to inform the council, to inform stakeholders. So what do you not see in here that would be useful to you? How can we improve it to make it more useful? So again, the past efforts on the State of the Ecosystem Report, developed one in 2009, another one in 2012, and these are PDFs or printed documents, so sort of a more old school way of communicating information. And currently, we've been putting sort of the next iterations on the web, and so it's a web link. And there's a menu, ecology of the Northeast Continental Shelf, and climate change information, ecosystem status, current conditions, spatial analyses, modeling approaches. It's all, you can look at it on the web, it's updated. We're not updating it every 2 years, we're updating different components of it as updates become available, just to make it a little more dynamic and a little more, not so stayed in time, but sort of a more fresh, current document. Uh, So again, we also are producing annual reports for the Fisheries Management Council. So the state of the ecosystem covers the Northeast U.S. continental shelf ecosystem, which is from Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, through the Gulf of Maine. So then we produce a report specific for the New England Fisheries Management Council, which is kind of, you know, Great South Channel through the Gulf of Maine. And we produce something for the Mid-Atlantic Fisheries Management Council, which is, you know, mostly Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, to Great South Channel. You know, the two regions overlap, so the information overlaps a little bit. But we develop these targeted reports for issues which are more relevant to New England or more relevant to the Mid-Atlantic. And we presented the Mid-Atlantic one in 2016 to the Mid-Atlantic SSC, and then we're on the calendars, hopefully, to present to both Mid-Atlantic and New England on the April 2017 meeting. And again, these are all available on the web. So looking at some of the different sections, you've got sections on climate drivers, regional climate indicators, base of the food web, which is primary and secondary productivity, fish and shellfish, so sort of trends in the resource, ecosystem services, stock determinations and species of special concern, other human activities and stressors, and putting it all together. So we're really trying to stretch these ecosystem reports from basic information about primary and secondary production into fish and shellfish fisheries and abundances in those resources, and then connecting it to ecosystem services. So fishing, there's energy information, the economics of living in resource management. So it's really trying to get, you know, the ecosystem defined in the broadest sense, from physical components all the way through the human components. And there's these indicator plots which show trends. So they show trends. So this is lobster in the spring in the Gulf of Maine. This is starting in 1980, so it's survey data. So you can see lobster in the Gulf of Maine in the spring has been increasing. So in recent years, it's positive, and that trend continues to increase. And then if you look at lobster in southern New England in the spring, it had been low. But in the most recent year, there's evidence of, you know, 1 year going up, so that it's low, but there's been an increase. When you look at lobster in fall survey, again, you've got in the Gulf of Maine this increase, and that trend is increasing. And if you look at Georges Bank or southern New England, it's either decreasing or sort of down and low. So trying to present information which is relevant to particular communities. So this was information on lobster. And the new outline that we're putting together for the next sort of online version, you know, it focuses on the big picture, describes the ecosystem as a whole, looks at humans in the system first. The past reports that we've done have looked at sort of the physical and biological characteristics of the ecosystem first, and then built the humans from there. This new version, we're starting with sort of the human interactions with the natural ecosystem, and then going down into resource species, protected species, the base of the ecosystem, the physics, and the underlying climate. And so this is sort of a conceptual diagram of how the report is connected. So again, we're starting with the sort of the human services that are received from the ecosystem, human activities, how they interact with ground fish, how they interact with marine habitat, and then down into sort of the ecological interactions, forage fish, and the fundamental climate and ocean drivers that are affecting the ecosystem from the bottom. And obviously that simple model, you know, conceptual model is too simple. These ecosystems are all highly connected, and so you can sort of follow these different components through in the report. So you can start at tourism and see what components of the ecosystem are connected to tourism, or you can start, look at profits in the fishing industry and follow through to see what components of the ecosystem are connected to profits. The other, again, part of this is we're really trying to make the connection to human communities. And so pulling in, there's an effort within the National Fisheries Service that's called the Social Indicators Project, and it brings in information about economic sort of income in coastal communities, and there's gentrification indices and real estate values and a whole host of other social indicators for all the coastal communities in the country. I mean, obviously, we're focusing on those indicators in the Northeast U.S., and there's two are shown here. So one on the left-hand side is the reliance on commercial fisheries. And so red means a high reliance on commercial fisheries, and green and small dot means low reliance on commercial fisheries. And you can see, you know, the high reliance on commercial fisheries in the state of Maine, it decreases as you go to the south, but you do have some ports with a high reliance on commercial fisheries. So you've got New Bedford, Cape May, some of the ports down this would be Wanchese in North Carolina. So you got a high reliance on commercial fisheries across the coastal Maine, and then sort of these specific points with high reliance on commercial fisheries as you go further down. And then on the other side, this is sort of the vulnerability to sea level rise. And so what the sort of authors of this component report have done is looked at all the businesses which have a link to seafood production, and then look at the elevation of those businesses, and then calculated the vulnerability of sort of that sort of fundamental business aspect on the shore side. And what you see, you know, again, in Maine, the vulnerability is relatively low. Most of the coast here has a lot of elevation to it, so you don't need to go too far from the high tide line to get to high elevation. But down when you get down to the mid-Atlantic, the coast is not as steep a difference from the coast. So you've got a lot of business, a lot of shoreside infrastructure, which is at a relatively low level, and that has a higher vulnerability to sea level rise. There's other sort of components to this social indicator, which will be presented and sort of in this report, and there's a lot more information than I have the opportunity to go through. On the biological side, trying to get at some more of the interactions, this shows fish condition. So the each row is a different species. So there's yellowtail flounder from southern New England at the top, Acadian redfish females at the bottom, and a whole host of species in between. And then it shows year from 1990 to the present. And what the shading is how fat the fish are. So at a given length, how much does a fish weigh? And the blue means you've got a fat fish, and the light blue means you have a thin fish. And what you see when you look at this pattern is you see a lot of, you know, sort of late 80s, early 90s to about 2000, sort of this block here, most of the species, a lot of the species were in high condition. For a given length, fish had a high weight. And then around 2000, a lot of the fish sort of are in this lighter blue, which is a low weight at a given length. So these are fish which are thin. So you see that change across a whole host of species. And then in recent years, from 2010 on, you're starting to see some of these species getting fat again, but you still have some species which are thin. So this is sort of you're looking at it from a fish perspective, but it's an indicator that there was something happened in the ecosystem around 2000, which was responsible for fish sort of losing condition, losing their fatness. And then something changed again, maybe in 2010. And so some of these species are putting on weight at a given length, so changing in their condition. Another component of the report is spatial distribution. These two plots show the spatial distribution of lobster from the trawl survey, which goes from Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, through the Gulf of Maine, and Acadian redfish from the trawl survey, which goes from Cape Hatteras to the Gulf of Maine. What you can see, lobster, so the base is 60s and 70s, and then the recent is in the 2010s, and the overlap, this bottom one, is where those distributions overlap. What you can see for lobster in the spring is the highest concentration used to be in the mid-Atlantic, southern New England, and now the highest concentration is up here in the Gulf of Maine. And this distribution in the resource is played out in the distribution of the fishery. Fishery used to largely be centered in Connecticut, New York, and has in the past 10 to 20 years really sort of grown in the state of Maine and decreased in the southern New England. So that the change in the fishery distribution matches the change in the resource. Acadian redfish, you see very little change in distribution. That, you know, there's almost 100% overlap from where Acadian redfish were in the 60s and 70s to where they are now. And this is one of the dichotomies that we see. You look at, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 species. Species which were occurred in the mid-Atlantic are moving, shifting northwards. Species which occur in the Gulf of Maine are pretty much staying in the Gulf of Maine. And then sort of the rationale, the hypothesis is that the Gulf of Maine is bathymetrically complex. So you have a lot of topography, a lot of different temperature water. So species can find the temperature water that that their preference is, but they don't need to go far to find it. Whereas the Mid-Atlantic Bight is sort of classic, smooth continental shelf. You know, and so they're moving, think of it as a field, and they're moving along that field to stay in their preferred temperature, which is to the north and offshore. Looking at just a couple of the other sort of macro indicators, so if we take all the benthos, all the animals that are on the bottom, this is sort of an index of the magnitude of biomass on the bottom. This is the sort of magnitude of sort of the mesoplanktivores, so forage fish, which are feeding. This is a macro planktivores, piscivores, and so trying to look at the structure of the ecosystem not from a given species or from male Acadian redfish and female Acadian redfish, but looking at species which are feeding on plankton, species which are feeding on other fish, species which are feeding on the bottom. The other component, again, is protected species, and so much of fisheries management happens under the Magnuson-Stevens Act. But there's other acts which NOAA Fisheries is responsible for, and that includes the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the Endangered Species Act. North Atlantic right whale is a marine mammal, so it's protected under the Marine Mammal Protected Act, but it's also highly endangered, so it's also protected under the Endangered Species Act. So this report, Status of Ecosystem, goes through and looks at trends in North Atlantic right whale and trends in other species which are protected under the Endangered Species Act. There had been recovery of North Atlantic right whale for a number of years. Slowly the population was increasing. But since about 2010, 2011, the recent estimates indicate the population is now decreasing. So the concern about the status of the North Atlantic right whale is going to come back to the forefront. I'm just going to skip through and get to temperature. So this is the sort of long-term temperature from observations, so bottom temperature observations in the ecosystem. This shows the data, sort of the average temperature over the region. And then this is sort of that sort of indicator plot format, which I showed before. And so the temperature is, you know, higher in the past several years than it has been, and it continues to increase. And so, we're trying to, in this ecosystem status report, cover a large area going from the physics and climate of the ecosystem through the secondary producers into the fish, shellfish, and then also sort of endangered species, and then how humans interact with the ecosystem in terms of fishing or seafood businesses, to try to really capture the status of the ecosystem as a whole. And so, you know, part of what, you know, that's sort of an outline report, but, you know, start the conversation about, you know, how can we improve how the information is conveyed, or what can we include which would be of use to you, or are there other pieces of information that we should consider including to make the report more relevant to stakeholders in the ecosystem. So I'd like to just kind of stop here. And just have a conversation or sort of question-answer or however you want to do it for the next 15, 20, maybe 30 minutes. And then I'll turn it over to John Manderson, who will talk about how he's trying to integrate some of the ecosystem information with fishing industry to understand the dynamics of the resource but also of the industry themselves. So questions, comments, discussion? I know that was a quick overview, so... There's a lot of information in these reports.
Is there a handheld mic up there?
Is there a handheld mic?
There was one earlier. No,
I don't see one. But I guess the quick summary is that, you know, the Gulf of Maine ecosystem is changing. You don't need me to tell you that. There's probably been a number of other people who've made that observation in the past. So the question is how do we deal with the changing ecosystem?
Yeah, and it seemed that, John, one of the things that you were sort of asking people was whether or not development, the information that you're putting together is the right information to answer the questions.
Correct.
And obviously, Cushman spent a lot more time on the water than anybody else does. So, inputs on that from, the community are always particularly helpful.
Correct. And I do know, I see Jim Manning sitting in the back. He has the environmental monitors on lobster traps program, which is measuring temperature since about 2003. Is that right, Jim?
2001.
And so, if you go into this report, you'll see summaries of the EMIL data as well as summaries of other data types. So some of the information here has been collected by fishermen. There's a lot more that can be learned.
So questions, comments?
Do it. Dave Cassoni, Massachusetts lobster, and I'm one of the victims of the northern right whale. Your decline is in the right whale indicates, well, it's speculative anyway. I mean, where I am in fishing in Cape Cod Bay, for those of you that don't know this, we have no lobstering for all of February, March, and April for a huge amount of territory. And it's because of the right whale. Granted, it's a buffet for them when they come up and there may be numbers. But if there is a decrease in them, what's the chances that there'll be a recovery for us? If you know what I mean. Rather than, there are fewer, so we got to go to more extremes to protect the fewer that are there. It's maybe not your decision, but it's certainly going to go from you and be pushed out.
Yeah, I'm not going to answer your question.
No, I don't even want to answer it.
I know better not to.
I kind of want to wake up a lot of these people to this realization.
No, and I think it is a very important point. North Atlantic right whale is covered under the Endangered Species Act.
And the Marine Mammal Protection.
Marine Mammal Protection Act as well. And recent data indicates that the population is no longer increasing, but it's decreasing. They migrate down south and calve off of eastern Florida and Georgia. The average number of calves per year is 10. This year there were 3. So you start, putting the pieces together, and I think, North Atlantic right whale is going to become an issue. I mean, I know it's an issue here already. It's going to be more of an issue. And I can't tell you what that means, but I think your point is exactly right. Everyone needs to think about, pay more attention to this topic because it's going to be coming up more and more.
The lobster industry, because of the vertical lines, regardless of whether we're inshore or offshore, 10 feet of water or on Georgia's bank, is subject to some type of regulations regarding, of all things, the right whale. At least, congratulations to NOAA for their efforts on the humpback whale and everything. That
was
good.
Recently delisted.
Delisted, which increased the PBR, which, we're looking at it. But if this decreases, then it goes down lower for our PBR type.
Right. And then, lobstering has a lot of vertical lines. The talk before this in this room was about seaweed aquaculture. Kelp aquaculture and mussel aquaculture is also vertical lines. And so this interaction between industry and protected species is an important one to keep focused on.
So just to follow up a little bit, John. Just to follow up a little bit on that. So when you see these right whales, and I know that there's a lot of attention given to them, do you have an opportunity to look at what the environmental impacts are for them and the conditions perhaps not prime for calving? Or is there any work that's being done on that might give us some information of why that number went down?
I mean, there's a lot of work. Well, you know, there's work being done in North Atlantic right whale. It's a challenging species to study because they're, you know, huge. There's like 400 of them, and they migrate, you know, from Florida into the Gulf of Maine. But, you know, there's this, there are sort of, their distribution seems to be changing. The calanus, which is their prey base, that the abundance of calanus has been fluctuating and changing some. And so there are sort of environmental conditions which seem to be changing for North Atlantic right whale. But, you know, the attribution to what could be causing this decline, you know, I don't think that the research is there to say that it's one thing over another. But certainly interactions with gear is going to be a point of attention.
I have a broad question about the Gulf Stream, the river in the ocean, and the AMOC, the meridional, how do you say it now?
Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation.
Yes, thank you very much. Thank you. It's changing, and I know NOAA is tracking and mapping it. Could you talk a bit about how that affects the Gulf of Maine?
So when you look at this, and there was a recent paper, but when you look at this warming signal, so this is temperature, northeast U.S. shelf. I don't know if it's Gulf of Maine specific or not, but it's increasing. In the Gulf of Maine in particular, I think, you know, you've maybe heard the number that it's warming faster than 99% of the world's ocean. I think that's a number which has probably been used at the forum before. A component of that warming is, you know, the air-sea interaction. So the atmosphere warms, the ocean warms. In the Gulf of Maine in particular, as the ocean warms, the Gulf Stream is shifting northwards. The Gulf Stream is a warm, salty body of water. And if you look at Northeast Channel, which is where most of the water enters the Gulf of Maine, that water has been becoming warmer and saltier. And so there's a circulation aspect to the warming of the Gulf of Maine in addition to an air-sea interaction. And so as the Gulf Stream, and the projections are, the Gulf Stream will continue to push forward, which will continue to bring more warmer, saltier water to the region.
So one thing I think a lot about is how management responds to these species moving. And I'm curious what the science tells us about when you could defensively say there's no more squid fishery in the Mid-Atlantic region. That regional council shouldn't have the authority to manage that, and now it should be under the North Atlantic or New England Regional Management Council, or black sea bass or squid or anything, because our management system is based on these geographies. And animals don't pay a lot of attention to those generally, but they're on the move, as you said. So I'm curious what the science says about that.
So I'm not sure the science can answer the question, when should management change? Science can answer the question that species distributions are changing, and that then the management side, the state, you know, some of the black sea bass, there's state allocation. And most people would agree that the state allocations are out of balance with the species distributions. And so that then becomes a management question as to how to think about ways to resolve that or not resolve that. But the science, you know, can clearly show that species distributions are changing. And it's important to note that, you know, a change in distribution can be several things. One is, you know, a shift, like you look at lobster, it's a clear shift from south to north. The other way distributions can change is an expansion. So in an expansion, it's not that you're not losing anything from a given area to another area. You're just getting more. And so I think for some species, it's an expansion. And for lobster, it's clearly a shift. And so I think it's important for management to think about those differences when they're making their considerations about how to change allocation. But the science can provide the information about the distribution of resource.
Hi. So I think in general that people involved in fisheries management recognize this as an issue. The Mid-Atlantic Council hosted a conference and invited the New England Council and the Southeast Council at least 4 or 5 years ago, I think. And I think there was a recognition around the room that these issues are you know, becoming more pressing. But I didn't hear were a lot of solutions. And I haven't yet. So I don't know. But it's a problem.
Don't we look to system science then? Because this involves everything.
Correct. And so, yeah, so system science is not my specialty. But it really, and I think a number of scientists in the region, no matter what their initial discipline is or was, are rapidly coming to the point where we realize we all need to work together. And there's, you know, 2 projects in the region, and there's many projects in the region, 2 that I'll call out. One is being led by Kathy Mills of GMRI. It's basically looking across the scientific disciplines, trying to link changes in climate and ocean conditions to changes in fishing communities, with a focus in Maine. Another project out of Northeastern, which is looking sort of slightly larger scale across the whole Northeast U.S., similar purpose to try to link these ecosystem changes, to understand the changes in communities, to try to help communities think about what they could do to adapt to the changes in the natural system. So yes, it very quickly is leading us to systems ecology, and I think we're very, you know, trying to catch up with that perspective. Right here, Mary Beth.
Hi there, I'm Ivy Osler from the Coastal Program, the Maine Coastal Program. I'm curious to know if there will be an increase in federal efforts to do high-resolution bathymetric mapping within the state to increase our coverage so that it's proportional to what the other New England states have down south, mostly from NOAA surveys. And I'm curious to know, just because of how important these data are for the habitat mapping.
I can't answer your question, but I can, like, what, phone a friend? Is that, I can find out for you if you give me your contact information.
Okay, great.
Which I talk to somebody who should be able to answer. We're going to turn it over to John Manderson. He's going to talk about, you know, this is sort of I gave a large, very large scale, slightly boring overview of the state of the Northeast U.S. shelf ecosystem. He's going to give you a much more interesting, more detailed view about some of the efforts that are underway. This is, okay.
So I'm very lucky to be working for NIMS, and particularly for bosses like John Hare and John Howey at Cooperative Research, because John's encouraged people to be entrepreneurial and innovative, and some of us are lucky enough to get to at least try that, and sometimes we fall flat on our face, and sometimes things work out. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give a talk about some work that I'm trying to develop with others, where we begin to work inside the industry with the industry to speed up the science and get better information about what's going on in the system in real time. So it's really about collaboration and crowdsourcing, what I would call seascape dynamics, to support sustainable fishing in rapidly changing ecosystems. And I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, which include John Hare and John Hoey, who's in the room, and Dave Richardson, who's not here. So I'm going to talk about 3 things as quickly as I can: a rationale for changing the approach that we take. The second topic will be the data available for creating a new approach. And finally, how one might go about creating a collaborative, real-time, adaptive system of at least doing science that can inform management. Now, why would we want to do this? The one thing that we know based on what John said John was talking about is that the systems are changing, and they're changing very fast, and from the perspective of the animals, or in terms of the biology of the animals, the habitats are changing locations and volume very quickly. The timing of habitat formation in the ocean is changing. The distributions are shifting, but there's also change in the productivity, and those changes are happening extremely quickly. The other thing that we know is that a third of the world's population depends on seafood for subsistence. So we're really in the sustainable food business. That's what our job is, and our job is to do the science to allow for sustainable fishing so that we can harvest resources as human animals from natural systems. And we're trying to do that in a very complex ecosystem, which includes both natural and human components that we have no control over. So we're in a complex, adaptive, self-organizing system with not all sorts of nonlinear interactions, and we're trying to figure out how to harvest resources in a sustainable way so that we can eat without crashing the ecosystem. So that's what our mission is, and that's what our mission is at NIMS, is to figure out how to do that in the marine environment and to provide the science that allows managers to make those decisions. So how would we build a real-time system which takes into account change? And it takes into account rapid change. And particularly in the ocean, this is important because we know that living in the ocean is different than living in a gas. The animals are what controls their movements and distribution is not gravity, it's drag. So they move with the fluid. They're tightly coupled to the properties of the fluid, and that fluid is tightly coupled to the dynamics of the atmosphere. So ironically, what happens is that the effects of climate change in the atmosphere happens much more quickly to the animals in the ocean than it does to animals on land, because animals on land are decoupled a little bit from the dynamics of the atmosphere because it's so harsh. In the ocean, that's not true. So things are happening very quickly in the ocean, and what we're doing in developing a seascape ecology is we're trying to study the relationships between ocean processes, particularly the fluid processes. We're not going to ignore the fluid processes anymore because we can't, because we know the changes that we see are associated with those. And we're going to look at the effects on individuals, populations, natural ecosystems, but we're also going to look at the human ecology. So the human ecology is key to sort of this integrated view of what ecosystems are. Now, if we think about the fluid, all right, the fluid itself is essentially turbulent. So we're talking about life in a turbulent fluid. And these are different scales of motions of the fluid going from diffusion and turbulence, waves, all the way to large-scale circulation, right? And if we think about what the animals are keyed onto, they're keyed into structure, structures in temperature, oxygen, salinity, predator and prey distributions, that structure is made by that turbulence of the fluid. So what we're trying to do is trying to understand how animals are reacting to the changes in structure due to this turbulent fluid that's connected to the atmosphere, and then how humans are then adapting to this change. So how do we know, given in this turbulent fluid, what's going on? So our attritional approach in terms of doing science is to depend on very carefully designed scientific surveys. This is the Northeast Fisheries Science Center survey that extends from Hatteras up to Newfoundland. It happens twice per year, and it is actually an amazing survey. All right, there's 300 stations across the scope for the whole entire Northwest Atlantic. So this is a great survey. It can contain all the information that we need to make adequate decisions about fisheries management, but we can't actually do what we have to do without it. What we need to do is understand what it's telling us and what both its benefits and pitfalls are. And one of the pitfalls of it is it doesn't take into account the seasonality of the ecosystem and how that is changing. It can sample certain habitats, like the ones inshore, very close to the coast, because the research vessel can't get in there. And the other thing is it measures what's going on in the ecosystem at a relatively broad spatial scale. In fact, we could plot the resolution of this survey on this map of the ocean. Right, so we've got, this is what the NIMF survey tells us. It tells us about the species habitat relationships and changes in productivity at those space-time scales on top of this dynamic ocean environment. So the question is, how can we supplement this survey information with other information that can give us a better view of what's going on in the ecosystem in real time? So how do we fill these ecological gaps? One thing we can do is we can do a set of experiments in a traditional scientific way. So on the left are some experiments that Vince Saba and his wife are doing on the metabolic, the effects of temperature and other physical parameters on the metabolism of animals in the lab. So we can do that, and we can project out what's going on, what's the results of those experiments across the ecosystem, and find something out from the lab. The next experiment on the right is a field experiment which Matt Breese and Matt Oliver at the University of Delaware are doing. And what they're doing is they're tagging sturgeon with acoustic tags, and they're following those sturgeon around using fixed stations and receivers, but also receivers on underwater robot gliders. And this is the track underneath. That black line that you'll see form is the track of a sturgeon, and that's satellite data that is showing you essentially the habitat characteristics that are being measured, where that animal is and where it's not. Right, so this is very high resolution data. It's telling us things that are happening outside the survey data and how the animals are moving. So there are a number of advantages to it, but there are also disadvantages, and that is their laboratory and field artifacts. We've got a population level experiment. Doing this at the scale of the population level is extremely expensive. We probably can't afford to do telemetry experiments at the scale of the whole population or whole populations. So there are practical constraints having to do with funding that limit the scope of these. So, but they're still important components of a research toolbox that we need to use to get our science up to date and to recognize the changes that are going on in the ecosystem. So the third way of doing things would be to go back to the way that we did business in the beginning of the 20th century up to about the 1960s. And that is, we used to do fishery science embedded with the fishing industry. Right? And these are some, Johan Hoard is a very important fisheries biologist who studied the great migrations of fish in Europe. He did his work embedded in the fishing industry. And William F. Thompson did work on flatfishes in the West Coast. And there are people here like Oscar Seti were doing stuff on mackerel, a very famous work that was done not separated from the industry. We weren't scientists blocked off in our boxes and labs. We were actually embedded with the industry, working with the industry to try to understand what was going on in the system in real time. So we can take this approach, and why would we want to do that? Because all the vital rates that we're interested in, all the growth, all the dying, and all being born are being done at fine scales that the industry understands. You guys operate at the scales at which the vital rates occur that affect our population growth. So that's why we would do this. Now, in the old days, we had very simple thermometers and very simple temperature sensors if we measured them all. But now what we've got is we've got tremendous resources to understand what's going on in the ocean real time. So this is an image of the components of an integrated ocean observation system in the Mid-Atlantic. So this is Maricus. You have your own integrated ocean observation system called NERICUS. Now in Maricus, what goes on is they take satellites from space, radar on the surface that's measuring surface currents across the whole
mid-Atlantic region. Underwater gliders, which are telling us the temperature and salinity and oxygen underwater, data from buoys, and all that data is being assimilated into ocean models to essentially nudge them so they're more accurate. They work just like meteorological models or weather models in the sense that they take real observations and they nudge them so they're more accurate. And we can access those. So we can access this data, and we have tools for digital communication, so we can access the data, and then we can send the products off, and we can build models like this. This is a model for longfin squid, and I made this this morning, and essentially it's a 40-day cast of this up till Monday. Right on the left is bottom temperature. The little balls are temperatures between 52 to 56. On the right is a habitat model that I built with a number of industry partners, and that's a projection of what's going on daily. So we have this possibility of working with the industry the way we used to in a new environment where we have this tremendous tools that essentially make the ocean, take the ocean from being an opaque field that we consider as a washing machine and chaotic to a system where that's transparent and we can see the dynamics of it. And this is where the nuts and bolts and the mechanisms that are causing distribution shifts, changes in productivity occur. So what we can do is we can structure a research program of cooperative research on top of that well-informed or well-monitored ocean or well-modeled ocean, and we can combine it with our traditional tools to make a better picture. So what we can do is daily we can look at the dynamics of the fleets on top of what these ocean models look like. And these are models from last year. One's on squid. The one on the right is on mackerel. There's a regulatory closed area there. So what we begin to learn when we do this is we have to take into account not just the effects of the ocean on the distribution of fishing vessels, but also the effects of economics on effort, on regulatory measures on effort. But we can do that in real time. So at a broad scale, at a whole ecosystem scale, we can measure the dynamics of fleet relative to the ocean in the context of these other human socioeconomic drivers that are controlling landings. So what we're doing is we're beginning to add scales of understanding to our original plot, was just covered by that Fisheries Independent Early Survey. Now, John Hoey, who heads up the Northeast Fisheries Cooperative Research Program, has a set of boats in study fleets. And those study fleets have computers on board in which they're making toe-by-toe, recording toe-by-toe information on what they catch. There are also sensors that measuring temperature. Jim's got some people in the lobster business working with current meters. And all that data is being integrated in a system where we have willing collaborators to work on specific topics. So in this case, this is a set of habitat models that we're developing to bring to bear to the next assessment, which is going to start occurring in early May of this year. So what this is these are habitat models that we co-developed with a number of boats in the mackerel fishery. We've evaluated them in real time, and what we're able to do is we're able to change the relationships that we're using to develop those habitat models. We can use the Fishery Independent Survey data that we use, which is the traditional way to do it. We can use study fleet data that we can get from the computers that John Hoey's been putting on the boats. And what we can even do is we can make models that fit what people think the pattern is like based on the mental model in their head. And we can go test all those models in the field in real time. And this is an evaluation of that habitat model. So what we can do with this is we'll develop a habitat model with the industry, and we're going to bring that to bear in the next assessment in 2017. So, and we've done that with this collaborative, and it's going to allow us to take into account these distribution shifts in the system, or we hope it will allow us to take into account the distributions of the, that have occurred in the mackerel stock in the system that have been observed, and their likely effects on the observation process in our surveys. The other thing we can do, so we've drilled downscale a little bit more by working with study fleets. We can also go out with individual boats and measure stuff in much more fine detail. This is a cruise that I made with a very close collaborative one named Chris Grobuck, and it shows data that we at least collected or measured during the cruise, and it shows the catches. And it shows, and you can actually look at this data and you can see in very fine scales what's controlling his catch and his bycatch. And what this allows us to do is allows us to understand at fine scales that we may not be able to model yet what's going on with the habitat distribution of these animals or what controls the habitat distribution of the animals. The other thing this does is, because it's collaborative, it gives him information that allows him to avoid bycatch in his fishery much more readily. So by working together, we're actually getting both benefits of this fine scale information that's giving us better information to make models that we can bring to bear in the assessment process and management process, giving him a better understanding of what's going on in the field that allows him to clean up his fishery. So again, we drilled down another set of scales. So we have this nested hierarchy of investigation embedded with a fishery in real time, and it's giving us all sorts of information about what's going on in real time. Now, in addition to this, we can walk out and have discussions with people. We can make these models, and then we can discuss them. And the interesting thing about doing this modeling is the modeling is an excuse to talk. And you start talking about all sorts of stuff that, as fisheries scientists, that we don't know, okay, which includes, in some cases, the effects of global geopolitics on the demand for fish and on effort, which is something that we don't understand. And you can begin to take those conversations and build a mental model of how the system operates, right? And this is the complex, this is what we're dealing with in fisheries. We're dealing with, what we typically deal with is the ecological system.